Chapter 4 of Genesis. So we'll start with Cain and Abel, because that's the next one after Adam and Eve. And I remember a comment on Cain as opposed to chapters 1 to 3. In chapters 1 to 3, Eve was talked into sin by the devil. He talked her into taking of the fruit of the tree. Cain wouldn't let God talk him out of sin, because then we get this conversation that takes place between Cain and God. And this is the place where certainly Cain is cursed. Up until now, although people talk very generally and glibly about being cursed and mankind being cursed because of the fall and so on, you'll notice that in chapter 3, verse 14, cursed are you above more than all the cattle. So the first element of cursing is against the serpent, it's against Satan. The second element is the earth, in verse 17, cursed is the ground because of you. So that's the devil and the world, if you like, or the ground, the material, is not going to respond well. And then you get into chapter 4, and the result of the story of Cain and Abel and the murder of Abel is verse 11, now you are cursed from the ground. We assume, because of the way the story is written, that it's an individual, namely Cain, that gets cursed. But from the way that we understand Genesis, obviously there are bigger issues at stake on the teaching and the theology of what Cain and Abel, just like Adam and Eve, are all about. And one of the interesting factors is that although in verse 1 it looks pretty obviously that it's one man and one woman, because that's the only way in which copulation can take place, when it says now the man had relations with his wife Eve, the definite article is in front of the word man, as it has been all the way through chapters 1 to 3. And the definite article is the man. It's as though he's been particularly looked at as both representative and symbol of mankind. The man was this, and the man. It's only when we get chapter 4 and into chapter 5 that we start to read man as a name, Adam, in other words, as a name. Here it's the man. Now, the man, does that mean that we're looking at a picture of, no doubt, has an individual basis to it, as some of us were thinking a couple of weeks ago, and that therefore there was an actual Adam? But are we seeing Adam as this representative body of humanity as a whole, fulfilling the command that man was to fill up the earth? Well, here it says, the man had relations with his wife, or knew his wife. To know his wife is just a euphemistic way of talking about sexual activity. Now, the man had relations with his wife, knew his wife, Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. Now, earlier it was said that, verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. Now, that's obviously an expression which is greater than simply the individuals concerned and the little family that's there. This is mankind. This is all the so-and-so born of woman. It's everyone's born of woman. It's mankind and the seed of the enemy attacking. But bringing forth this fruit, gave birth to Cain, is going to give us a little bit of a clue as to why Jesus, a bit later, some thousands of years later, is going to say, you are of your father the devil. So there's the seed of the devil. And he was a murderer from the beginning, and his deeds you will do. How do we know that Satan was a murderer from the beginning? Well, we might say, well, he led them into sin, so that in the day you eat thereof, you will surely die. Well, he's murdering off mankind. But here is an expression coming of where death actually does come in through murder. And it is one of the seeds. And it's this particular seed, Cain, who is going to stand for the all the, if you like, the murderers from the beginning, which are the negative, they are the seed of Satan. And on the other hand, Abel, who was murdered, is going to stand as the righteous and will be those who the warfare is taking place between. So the warfare between the woman and the serpent, which has been prophesied, or between the seed and the seed, is now going to be expressed in chapter 4. That is the logical development. We want to know what this warfare is all about. Now it appears. When we, Sunday school wise, give stories about Adam and Eve and then stories about Cain and Abel, we are forgetting that there is a very logical progression taking place, an intimate and integrated progression. And now we're getting an illustration of what it means, because we're puzzling a bit about it. Seed of serpent, does it mean the devil can reproduce and have lots of demons around? Well, the answer is no, that's not really what's in view. Here's what's in view. It's the Cains of this world are the seed of the devil. It's the Abels of this world who are being warred against and who are murdered. And it is Satan who's a murderer from the beginning, and his deeds you will do. Here's the first evidence of it. So there is an interpretation in Genesis as to who the seed of the enemy really is. You remember it was all in the context of you're born of fornication, and Jesus is saying you were born of the devil, you are the seed of the serpent, sort of thing. And we wonder, what is that a valid interpretation? Well, here it is. This is the interpretation of Genesis chapter 3, now found in Genesis chapter 4. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man child with the help of the Lord, is the general and very prevalent way of translating it. But I wonder if, and Luther, I believe, if I remember rightly, took this view. You can actually translate this, as some of you will see in the margin. I have gotten a man, I have begotten a man, then in apposition, the Lord. What man? The Lord. Well, who is this one? Well, it's the one that's just been prophesied in chapter 3, is going to crush the serpent's head. And as far as Eve was concerned, did she think that this is going to be the solution to the problem? She's called the mother of all living. She has faith. She has hope. Adam has faith. And here is somebody appearing on the scene through birth. Is this the fulfillment, as we've seen, we've already seen that the seed of Satan is interpreted by chapter 4. Here we go, back to verse 1. I've gotten a man, the Lord. And that could be just simply her expressing her desire, her hunger, her longing that this solution that has been promised to their sin is going to be met and undone. And she gave birth to his brother Abel. So another one comes along. And Abel was a keeper of the flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came in course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. A bit later on we're going to see that Cain moved away and went east. So there is a sense, it seems to me, that we're expected to understand that Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel are just outside the gates of the garden. And that's where they still worshipped. They couldn't go into the garden, but they could worship there. And so there was an obvious place where they could respond, and where it seemed, what else can we do? We've got messed the whole thing up, but where do we go? And being there, worship was a fundamental part of their life and activity together. Now, did Abel consider that a fundamental part of approaching God was that you have to put on skins? Because that's what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve. So maybe Abel had in mind, there has to be a death in order that I might go in and worship. And we know, of course, that's absolutely true. But I don't know whether we can go much further than that. A lot of people read in and say, well, his was a blood offering, whereas Cain's offering was a meal offering. But both are acceptable as offerings. It's true the meal offering was nearly always offered with a blood offering, But there's an exception at Pentecost when they offer up the meal offering with leaven in it. But generally speaking, all the regular offerings that took place, the sin offering, the trespass offering, the guilt offering, as it were, the fellowship offering, the burnt offering, they all were accompanied by a meal offering. So it is questionable as to how much we should put an emphasis on the fact that it was an animal that was killed for Abel, and that made it a good offering, where it was a meal offering. It's a part of their occupation. One man's always dealing with the animals, one man's always dealing with the crops of the ground. And it isn't that which the Bible or the New Testament emphasizes, that it's a blood offering, that comes out. Although, as I say, we can have a little hint, and we wouldn't be too far wrong to say that possibly they were taught that skins or covering was necessary to approach God. But that isn't the main thrust of the story. But Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time. Cain brought an offering of the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Something which is perfectly acceptable in the Levitical sacrifices, which later are going to be revealed. Abel, on his part, brought the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portion. It is perhaps significant, more significant, that the firstlings of his flock and their fat portions are reckoned to be the excellent part of the flock as a whole. One, it wasn't some old, half-bitten old animal. It was the choice. It was the firstlings. And secondly, it was the fat. And the fat was that which was in Levitical sacrifice, always offered to God. So there is something of excellence in the offering that Abel is making, whereas nothing hints at all at the supreme or primordial or the excellence of Cain's offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard, because all that we've read about Cain is the fruit of the ground. Could have been anything. Could have been an old squash tomato or something, but not necessarily a particularly significant statement made about it. So there is a difference in the way that the offerings are described. And the Lord said to Cain, verse 5, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering. For Cain and his offering he had no regard. So there was something wrong with the offering, or maybe the way that he offered. The thing that was wrong might be that it wasn't the best part of the offering he could give, whereas with Abel it certainly was. Just a vague little hint that possibly skins or death was required somewhere within the offering. But we're only guessing when we say that. There's nothing in the actual text. So what does the New Testament say about why one is accepted, one is regarded, and the other is not? And if we move into the New Testament, first of all, we'll read into Hebrews in chapter 11, verse 4. By faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice. So Hebrews' definition of the reason why a sacrifice was a better one is that it was because it was done by faith. Of course, for those of us who know we're justified by faith, sanctified by faith, walk in faith, etc., etc., it's terribly significant that on the first pages of the Bible, in trying to restore fallen mankind, faith is an essential ingredient that is being hinted at in this first story. So by faith Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. So the offering, in a sense, brought him into a right relationship with God, testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. So although he was killed, of course, by Cain, he still is speaking. He's still bringing forth, as it says over in chapter, chapter 12, and in verse 24, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better than the blood of Abel. So the sprinkled blood of Jesus is speaking to us that there is a way into the Holy of Holies. The blood of Abel is that which speaks to us, saying that it is an offering that's made by faith that enables us to enter in. They're both speaking to us, but the blood of Jesus is clearly welcoming us into the presence of God. But there's another place where Cain is mentioned, and of course that's in John's epistle, John's first epistle, and chapter 3, verse 11 of John's epistle. For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain. So those two brothers at the beginning of history should have loved one another, not as Cain, who was the evil one and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. So the first bloodshed, if one wanted to be dramatic, the first war in the Bible is a religious war, and it's born out of envy. It's born out of coveting the relationship that one man has, because he receives it by faith, as opposed to what the works of Cain did not achieve, which he thought that he ought to be received. In other words, his attitude was not that of a dependent who throws himself onto the mercy of God and believes it's somebody who is trying to earn a position. So it was the attitude in right way back in chapter 4 of the beginning of the Bible. We see that this whole two lines of people are beginning to emerge. There are those who acknowledge that in themselves they have nothing, but they need a sacrifice to enter in. And there are those who are stirred up and envious and competitive and hateful against their brothers, because they haven't got that peace in their hearts of a knowledge of a relationship with God. So those are the New Testament reasons. It goes on to say that he was that evil one, and therefore, you know, he murders. The taking of that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Terribly significant, isn't it? Of course, it can be forgiven, but it does make you wonder about these people who have murdered heretics all the way through history, and those who have claimed that they're murdering in behalf of the name of the Lord. No murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Well, may they be forgiven and receive eternal life, that it may abide in them, but it's not, that's, you know, of God's grace and mercy. It's not what God intended. Back to verse 7. If you do well, presumably meaning that if you behave in the way that you were meant to in coming in worship, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? In other words, you will have access, you'll be received. To smile upon a person's countenance, or to lift up a person's countenance, is that they're accepted. They've been accepted. Why are you angry, and is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? Doing well doesn't mean doing a lot of good works necessarily. It simply means you do well by living in faith. It is by trusting and making a better offering, according to Hebrews 11, which is an offering by faith. And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Now, quite clearly, sin here is personified. It isn't just simply breaking a rule. Sin is alive and active, and it's seeking to control. I think it's the difference, and I believe it's a biblical difference, between sin and sins. Sins are specific acts. Sin is the body of the devil, is the body made up of, spiritual body of the devil. It's a force. So it's virtually equivalent to Satan himself. And you get the same impression as you read through Romans chapters 5 to Romans 5 to 8, that the sin is waiting to rise up and take over Paul. Sin was alive, I was alive once without the law. The law came, sin relived, as though it was an entity coming alive again and taking over. And sin reigns in chapter 5 of Romans. So you don't have a thing reigning, it's a person, it's an enemy activity to reign. And so here, if you like, the kingdom of Satan is beginning to materialize, and it's materializing and expressing itself. Sin was not in the world before this. The world, which generally speaking, not always, but generally in Scripture, is the relationships of men and women together without God. The relationships of men and women together without God. So Satan comes into the world. Sin entered the world through the sin of Adam, through what Adam did. This power, this force, sin, which we're saying is Satan, comes into the world and is now lodged into the structures of the world, or of the relationships between men and women. And so he's lurking there waiting. That is the disadvantage that has arisen. It isn't this Augustinian business of a lump of something being passed on from body to body through the act of copulation. What we've got is now into the very structures of society, and that isn't just simply, oh, it's environmental. No, it's within our relationships. It's in the institutions of mankind. Sin is in the world now. It wasn't there before. So it's interesting, there's not an awful lot said about Adam in Jewish literature, but there isn't a lot in the New Testament. It's Paul that takes up Adam and says that, as in, you know, he tells how Adam sinned and death entered the world through sin, and sin entered the world. So sin now is a power, is a force working in the structures of humanity. And also, death follows on from sin. Death entered after sin. And so death is the end product of that activity of Satan within the construct of the world. So sin is crouching at the door like a dog, sort of half asleep, cocking one eye, waiting to when he's going to pounce. Sin is crouching at the door, but his objective is, his desire is towards you. And I made the parallel, it says earlier on in chapter 3, surely we interpret chapter 4 in the light of chapter 3, and it must do. I mean, as I've shown you already, it's just building one upon the other. And in chapter 3 it says that the desire of woman was towards the man, the husband. And that doesn't mean that she wants to run into his arms at any minute, because it just isn't true. Ask any husband. It's the it's the desire of the woman is to maneuver and manipulate her husband, because she is the weaker physical, weaker vessel. And so she has to maneuver and manipulate. And here is the devil maneuvering and manipulating in order to capture human beings and to bring them under his reign. And sin reigned, and reigned in, and death reigned. In the alternatives that Christ has brought in, now there is another world in which to live, and it's the world in which his righteousness is active, and that he doing right things, his spirit is at work, and grace is the important factor. And it's not as though he's got one eye cocked like an animal lying by the door, but it says that grace reigns, and we reign in life by one man, Christ Jesus. So there are two setups, there are two structures that have come into the world, and they are using these mankind in these different ways. So sin's lying at the door, waiting to pounce on you and bring you into some disadvantage. And verse 7, if you do well, and you must master it. And of course it was said that Eve was desire towards her husband, and then it says, and you will master her, and he shall rule over you. Same word, he shall rule over you. Verse 16 here, you will rule over it. So it doesn't say that Cain was born a sinner and therefore could not reign over sin. He's been told the opposite. Unless God is just mocking us and says, well, you can't possibly reign, you know. And therefore, although I don't agree with it, the idea that came in with Irving, the Irvingites, tongue-speaking movement in the 1830s onwards, the idea, and he's being taken more seriously today than he ever was in his own lifetime. He was a theologian who said that Jesus was made in the likeness of sinful flesh, means he was in sinful flesh, but he never sinned. Now he's having to try to find his way through Augustine, who's saying that Jesus couldn't have had an easier time, says Irving, in life and in overcoming sin than we have. Because we assume that Jesus must have had an easier time because we were born with sin and he wasn't. And so he tried to counteract by saying Jesus was born with sin but never sinned. Better still is to say that all of us are in the place where we make our choices and let sin reign in us or not. And we are challenged by God, and this is what it says here, well, you jolly well master it, so it must be possible. Well, we know that Jesus did. Every time he mastered it, he always overcame it. But we all don't, and I think I've made the point before, but it's worth it while I'm on it. If we could say, well, of course he didn't because he didn't have sin in him, we do because we're born sinners, we are trying to find out a reason why everybody sins. But if you could find a reason why everybody sins, you've exonerated us all. Have you got me? If there is a reason why everybody sins, that means that we are made to do it. This is what made you do it. This is the reason why you sinned. You sinned because you were born with sin in you. You sinned because you were born with a psychology of sin, or whatever it is. But if that is the case, then sin is not culpable, and it is wrong for God to judge us. But if we are born into a situation where we make choices, and surely this is what this chapter is about, post-fall humanity looks like Cain making this choice, and God saying to Cain, you must rule over sin. Why are you being miserable? Why are you cast down? Lift up your countenance. I want you to overcome sin. But he doesn't. So it's significant that, you know, we've got chapter 4 of Genesis there, because this is the state we're all in after Adam. Adam may have been in a privileged condition, he may have been in an advantageous situation. But from Cain onwards, we're all the same. We're born into a situation where the challenge to us, God whispering in our hearts, you must overcome, you must master sin, you mustn't let it take you over. The firstborn was offered to God, not necessarily because in itself it was better than any other animals that were going to be born of that, but it was to say, it was like a token that all life comes from God. So the firstborn we're offering back to you. And in that sense, it's the best as far as the animal is concerned that's produced it. But from the point of view of, well, it is the firstlings of the flock is where you start. Oh, I'm getting rich. I've got an animal. Oh, no, I've got to offer it to God.
The faith element would be the faith is that there will be another.
There'll be another one. Yeah. And that faith was justified too with the humans here, wasn't it? In the sense, there was a Cain, but there was also another one. There was an Abel. So, verse 8. Cain told Abel his brother, and it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Maybe there is another hint in the firstborn being offered that what we've got here is that Cain is forfeiting his firstborn rights, which are going to be developed later on. We don't know them yet, but when we get to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then into the law, the firstborn is very, very important, and you can lose your firstborn rights. And so when you get to to Hebrews chapter 12. We've already seen that there's an allusion to, there's an interpretation of Cain and Abel in chapter 11, and there's a reference to Abel in chapter 12, but halfway through chapter 12, for that second reference, it says, "Pursue peace with all men, and the sanctification without which no man will see the Lord. See to it, none of you comes short of the grace of God." Verse 16, "And that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau." Now, we don't know Esau was immoral, but we know he was godless. "Who sold his own birthright," which literally is the firstborn portion. It's the word for first, got the word first in it. The first portion, "for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing of the firstborn, he was rejected because Abel had got it." Over into chapter 22, it says, "We are come to Mount Zion, to the myriads of angels," verse 23, "and to the general assembly of the church of the firstborn," protokos, the firstborn. So we're the ideal is the firstborn always, and that's which is given to God. So there is perhaps just a slight allusion that Cain is forfeiting his firstborn rights, because just as Esau did when he threw away his birthright, and how possibly Reuben should be read into verse 16, the immoral man who lost his firstborn rights. He was the firstborn of Jacob. He was the firstborn of Jacob, and he lost his firstborn rights because he defiled his father's bed. He took one of his wives of his father. So that, it looks at the beginning of the Bible here. The firstborn concept is just beginning to be birthed and brought into view. Explicitly in the word firstborn offered by Abel, implying maybe he was acting like a firstborn, whereas Cain, he is just dismissing it all and killing the man who offered the firstborn. Verse 9. "Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother?" In chapter 3, God has said, "Where are you, Adam?" Now he's saying, "Where is your brother, Abel?" Where is your brother? A very good question. "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Well, in one sense, yes. You are your brother's keeper. You're meant to love him. You're meant to show your love in such a way that everybody can see your family. "Where is Abel, your brother?" Well, I've treated him as a thing, not a brother. He said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" He said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood." Now, of course, this again is very metaphorical. We don't literally think that blood has got a mouth that's saying things and shouting out. These people who say you've got to read Genesis literally and only literally have never read the book of Genesis and never read these chapters. If it was literal, then blood's got a little bit of a mouth on it. Your brother's blood, and it's obvious what it means. It's a metaphor, like so much that's in these texts. The blood of your brother, your brother's mouth, to receive your brother's blood from your hand. You are cursed on the ground, which has opened its mouth. So there's the voice of the, there's the mouth of the brother's blood. There's the mouth of the ground. There are mouths all over the place here, if you can take it literally. To receive your brother's blood. And the ground's mouth is drinking in the blood from your hand. And when you cultivate the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. Well, we've already had problems with the ground back in chapter 3. Cursed is the ground because of you. Now the ground, it seems, is even more destroyed by this activity. We do defile the earth, the platform, the home that we've been put into. You are cursed from the ground which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. You shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Now again, it's not God necessarily saying, I'm going to punish you, you're going to have a rough old time, you're going to stop being a gardener and you're going to start to be a farmer. He was just simply saying, this is the result of what takes place when we're out of joint with the Creator, we're out of joint with the creature. We're out of joint with the creation. And the world is not going to respond to us as it was intended to. And so you're going to have to struggle away to try and get anything out of it. You're cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your blood as bread from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. So you've really got to fight with it. Just like the seed is fighting one another, and you're fighting God, and you're fighting each other, and you're fighting the ground, and man and woman are fighting each other to try and get the precedence over one another. This warfare is the result. And it needs perhaps to be said that this warfare is called God's wrath. God's wrath. You read Romans chapter 1, this is the wrath of God at work. The wrath of God is being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. We ought to be able to see it, that something's gone wrong. It's out of joint. And interestingly enough, for all the political correctness, as far as Paul is concerned, and far as Christians who read their Bibles, I hope there are some, are concerned, the homosexual issue is not because we've got something against sex, or that we're everybody's sex-obsessed. The whole thing is that it reveals in the very body of mankind that something is out of joint. Well, what is out of joint, according to Romans chapter 1, is that we have rejected God. And therefore, we reject each other. And therefore, nothing fits. And consequently, homosexuality is simply a symbol of the state that we are in. It does not fit. And they will go on forever and ever and ever being politically correct. And I'm glad that homosexuals are treated with love and care and rights and so on. But nobody's ever going to convince anybody, really, not really, that the kind of practices that exist in homosexuality ever were meant to fit together. It is just lunacy to even think so. The structure of the human frame is that which tells us if that is not what is going on, something has gone terribly wrong. And what's gone terribly wrong is that we put man in the place of God. There is no way of saying that's God, that's man, that's God, that's Satan, that's God, that's light, that's darkness, that's right, that's wrong. Absolutes have completely gone. Everything is relative. So anything can be done. And if it can be done, we're going to do it, they say. This is one of their cries, isn't it? If it can be done, we should do it. It's the philosophy of the world. But in actual fact, it's screaming against the whole structure of the universe. And so this is where it all begins. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. So ever since then, mankind has been trying not to be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Because it is a part of the destruction that's come upon us. We try to have relationships. We try to find, putting it in pop terms, we try to find love. We never find it. We wander around the earth and move from place to place. Oh, if we move down the street, it would be better. If we move off to the coast, it would be better. If we move into another country, it would be better. We're always on the move, thinking that we're going to reach paradise sometime. But in fact, we're going to move further and further and further away from paradise. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. I think it is. People will argue against that, but I think that mankind's condition, our situation is not better. Because we don't send children down the mines anymore, but there's the trafficking of children into the sex game all over the earth, far worse than sending children down the mines in the 19th century. Mm. So where are we advancing? And we're not advancing. A little bit here and a little bit there, we might improve things, but mankind as a whole is getting into a worse and worse and state. It's not frightening, I suppose, if we can trust God, but that just a little bit of smoke coming out of a volcano and the whole of the jolly world stops. We now can't get our lettuces because they've all been now sold off to Spain, and we have to fish them in on the planes. You know, but that's just a silly illustration, but you know what I mean. We could easily be in the place where we're starving to death because we don't grow our own crops anymore. We're in the European Union, and therefore we've got to let them produce the beans and let them produce the potatoes, and that, you know, we're lunacy, the whole thing's becoming. But there you are. We are in a world that is not acknowledging God, so it's not surprising things get worse and worse. You'll be a vagrant and a wanderer, an alien. It won't fit. You'll always be on the move, trying to find something better. And Cain said to the Lord, I'm very sorry what I've done. Well, he didn't, did he? He complained. My punishment is too great to bear. You're being too hard on me. That's what he's saying. And isn't that always the case? That God is too hard on us? When in actual fact, all we've done is walked over a precipice and we were complaining to God that we're, you know, on a downward spiral, and one day we're going to hit the deck. And the whole of our response to God is that we're complaint. We're much too hard. We should never have all this. It should never happen to a nice guy like me, you know. My punishment is too great to bear. And behold, you have driven me this day from the face of the ground. And from your face I will be hidden. So it's your fault, really. You're driving me away from your face. And I shall be a vagrant and a wanderer in the earth. And it will come about that whoever finds me will kill me. Now again, of course, that is a clear statement that there were other human beings around at the time. The world was not just one great vast place in which Adam and Eve and now only Cain exist. There must have been others, otherwise it was a meaningless statement. It is meaningful because however it was, I've various suggestions, but it'd be going off subject, but that mankind came to his full spiritual stature under Adam, or at that particular phase in the development of the bodies of human beings. So no problem if you want to see an evolutionary process taking place. That's not the same thing as God breathing the breath of life into Adam, and a whole spiritual realm opening up into this creature that's now a living soul, which before was merely an animal. Now this living soul is in touch with the breath of God, and that's a different phase in mankind's development, and that's what's been going on here. But it does mean that, no doubt, having breathed upon Adam, he's breathing upon everybody else. And that mankind is coming into this position. And if other of these developed human beings that God has brought into being are around me, they will murder me because I've been a murderer. That's what he's saying here. And what went on in his life is symbolic of what's gone on in other people's lives too. So, verse 14. You've driven me this day from the face of the ground, from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a vagrant and a wanderer in the earth, and it will come about whoever finds me will kill me. It means that from the face of the earth, of course, nothing's fitting. And from the face of God, that's why it's happening. So the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, lest anyone finding him should slay him. If anyone, therefore, the first murderer was not executed, later on, he will be permission will be given to show that the world runs on the balance of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. That's the only basis for any justice anywhere. But God here is overriding, in a sense, justice and saying, okay, I'll give you another chance. And that chance will be that I will be the one who takes vengeance. Not mankind. I haven't given mankind the right to take vengeance yet. He will do when we get to Noah, because things have got so bad, it's even God has to realize that something has to be done to try and deter the product of sin. But here, at this stage of things, he's allowed to go on living, and the vengeance is implied, which we read later on, vengeance is mine, I will repay. It will be God who looks after him. is God will somehow or other take vengeance on those who try to get retribution upon Cain. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain. We don't know what that sign is, lest anyone finding him should slay him. We do know what it stands for. It stands for the fact that God is protecting even those who are sinners and who have rebelled against him and have taken even as much as the lives of others. God's hand of protection is promised to Cain from his fellow human beings. Maybe that's why sometimes we say that human beings are sometimes more strict than God is. Well, that isn't quite true, because the whole universe is saying how strict God is. You break the rules, you pay the consequences. That's God. But in the way that he's dealing with us morally, he gives us a chance. And this is the chance he's given here to Cain. Otherwise, we'd all be obliterated as soon as we sin. But he doesn't do that. And this is what he's showing us here. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, which must mean that he moved away from the gate of the Garden of Eden, where no doubt he'd tried to go on, well, the family had tried to go on worshipping, where the cherubim were. This is all going to be reproduced again when Israel is set up and the cherubim stand over the mercy seat, and then all around the tent. It's a kind of a reconditioning of what was lost. But at this point, he's moving away from what was the embryonic tabernacle, the Garden of Eden. And I've made the point to you before, I'm sure, that the candelabra that looked like a tree with fruit on it was an evidence that the idea of the Holy of Holies and the holy place and the cherubim who were all around the tabernacle I call it the embryonic tabernacle. They're all trying to recover the rest of God, where God is at rest, where God will speak to us, where God will settle down so we can settle down with him. God is trying to recover that. But here is Cain moving further away from it. So he went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of wandering, of Nod, the land of wandering, east of Eden. Well, you know that it's been taken up even by modern writers, east of Eden. It's the idea, of course, that you're moving away to the east, perhaps looking for light, the sun in the mornings, away with your back towards the back towards where you came from. You get to the back towards God and his revelation. It's important to get into our minds, I think, that the tabernacle was the other way round from temples and from cathedrals and churches. You realize that the altar and the holy place, rather I should say, the mercy seat, was to the west, and the gate of the tabernacle was to the east. And so it's almost the logical way to go, to get away from the presence of God, because you go in through the gate, is to go east. Not run round the back of the tent and go, or the garden or whatever, and go west. So it certainly was meant to be seen as symbolic. He's putting his back on God. He's looking towards a new day, but that new day never comes. Well, it comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. And he moves towards the east of Eden. And Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. He built a city and called the name of the city Enoch after the name of his son. It means initiation or dedication. Verse 18, and now to Enoch was born Irad. Irad became the father of Mahiliel. Mahiliel became the father of Methusiel. These names are very similar to the names that belong to the descendants of Seth that we'll read about in a minute. Lamech took to himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. And Adah gave birth to Jabal, and was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock, commerce and enterprise. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those that play the lyre and the pipe. I made a note here about verse 15. The mark is the unseen protection of God which keeps him alive. And so he's seeking security, struggling versus hostility. Men and nature apparently guarantees within reach, but don't receive. They're saying that there is something to go for, but we never get there. History, light's gone out, can't quite read it now. anyway, civilization, in a sense, is starting, putting our backs on paradise and trying to build cities. And it might be helpful, I think. Yeah. Just one other thing, perhaps, to emphasize is that I didn't bring out the point that verse 17, that he must have found a wife somewhere. Of course, those so-called purists, or I don't think they are purely interpreting the Bible correctly, were saying he had to marry a sister. And that was all right, because there's no legislation against it yet. But in actual fact, it doesn't sound like that at all. It's just that it doesn't say any sisters around. He just pops off and he finds a wife away from Eden, moving east. And then polygamy comes in. Zillah gave birth to Tubal Cain, the forge of implements of bronze and iron. Lamech and his wives showing off. Ada and Zillah, listen to my voicings. He's an arrogant old so-and-so he is. You wives of Lamech, give heed to my speech. I've killed a man for wounding me, a boy for striking me. Oh, you great big bully. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Well, it's just presuming on the grace of God, isn't it? Saying if Cain gets away with it and God protecting him, then I'll get away with it too, and I'll go even further. Well, violence and warfare have started. The first war, as I say, was a religious war, and it's always in the end a war between ideologies. And sometimes we may see it in terms of the gods of the various nations and God himself. And on the other hand, here we've got other aspects coming in of murder and feeling, in a sense, guilty. I'm not accepted of God. And often that is one of the driving motives in people that make them such miserable so-and-sos, and they compete and try to put down everybody else. Well, that's mankind. Let's jump on now, because we've got to look into Noah. So we have to miss a bit of text, 11:45. You'll see that the alternative line begins, chapter 5, verse 26 of chapter 4. To Seth also a son was born, and he called him Enosh. And we're starting now the line on Seth took the place of Abel, verse 25. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when he created man, he made him in the likeness of God. As an emphasis, once more, on the image and likeness of God, he created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became, and so, I think when it says he lived 130 years and then so-and-so was born, this one lived so-and-so, he was born, I think one of the ways of trying to understand the great lengths of these periods, and even longer periods would be necessary to understand it with our present day of civilization, is that the length, the actual birth of a child mentioned when you're so old, or 105 years or something like that, might not necessarily mean it was that child. It might have been that the grandfather is being mentioned as having brought forth his son, who then had the grandson. You see what I mean? And the birth is measured from the birth of the son rather than the grandson. That is one way of seeing that this is probably a longer period than these actual names are attached to. But longevity goes on until we get to chapter 6 and the flood. And that longevity is testified to by, it's almost prehistory stuff, of course, but anthropologists sometimes have come up with indications that there was a tradition at least of longevity, that people, in fact, so this is mild stuff in comparison to 25,000 years that one Babylonian king was meant to reign. But there you are, they have these long dates. And you know also, of course, when we're coming into chapter 6 and the flood, the Gilgamesh epic contains this passage of a flood account, which has similarities but also significant differences from the story of Noah. And that almost every culture that we can tap into, which is as ancient as this, there are always some sort of flood stories of some kind of expression, that it's left a very deep mark upon the human race that such a time took place when mankind was obliterated. So here are all the, this is supposed to be, you might say this is the Adam-Seth line, and it runs right the way down to Noah himself. In Enoch is the only one who was taken, you remember, didn't die. Verse 28, Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah. That's number 10. If you look back into chapter 4, you would have found a line of 10 from Cain. Now we've got a line of starting with Adam. Here we've got a line of 10 finishing with Noah. So some people have thought, well, one is the ungodly seed and the other is the godly seed. It doesn't exactly say that. It does say, of course, that there was a godly man, Enoch, but all of them died, and he died, and he died, and he died. The problem of death entering the world through sin is obviously being emphasized. And when we get to verse 29, he called his name Noah, saying, this one shall give us rest from the work and the toil of our hands, arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. So it's looking for some respite from the cursed earth, and it's looking for the rest which the first chapter of Genesis and chapter 2 verses 1 to 4 is showing is the objective of creation. It is to enter into the rest of God. It's that the whole of the universe should enter, where there remains a Sabbath rest unto the people of God. And that therefore is imprinted on this story, to move out of death and out of unbelief and out of all the disturbance that comes from living in a world that's anti us, and looking for rest from our toil and from the ground which is cursed, and finding God's blessing. Lamech lived 595 years, became the father of Noah. He had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. Noah was 500 years old when Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I don't think necessarily we have to understand that they were triplets. I think it could be a more general statement. He was 500 years, then the eldest one was born, and then the next one came, and the next one came. Chapter 6. Now it came about when the man, literally again, back to the definite article, mankind, when men, many translate, when the man began to multiply on the face of the land, showing that statements that were made to the man, to Adam, were implying a corporate understanding of what he stood for, a corporate mankind, when they began to multiply on the face of the land or the ground. Verse 29 reminds us, the ground the Lord had cursed, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, or they were good to look at, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Now this has been a problem of interpretation, and if we're going to look at the flood where it all gets washed away, it's still worthy of just a few minutes of trying to get a little bit into it. There are three possibilities. The sons of God are either, and this is the position I tend to, and interestingly enough, most conservative scholarly interpreters do today, is that the sons of God are spirit beings. Angels, demons, they are spirit beings. They are the sons of God that turn up in the book of Job, and Satan was amongst them. And so there were good ones and there were bad ones. They are the sons of God mentioned in Psalm 82. How long will you go on frustrating all these things and doing these things? And he says, you are the sons of the Most High. I've called you sons of the Most High. So they are, as it were, spirit beings, like God, who is a spirit and is the father of all spirits. And so it is not surprising that they would be called sons of God. But this is their first mention in Scripture, not often again. Later, Israel is going to be called son of God. Israel is the son of God. First, out of Egypt have I brought my son. Then, of course, Jesus is the son of God. And then, of course, we are sons and daughters of God. So it is, and I think it's emphasizing the spirit nature of the creature that's in view here. There are other interpretations, and the strong sort of Reformation teaching and expositions for some centuries used to be that the line, and if you're a Calvinist, you can see why, God just Calvinistically determined that the line of Cain were all going to be a load of rotters and they're going to be got rid of, whereas the line of Seth, they were all going to be the goodies and God has chosen to save them. And so there were the sons of God are the line of Seth, and the sons of the devil are that line of Cain. Doesn't seem to be quite what's being said here. It came about when men began to multiply and to face the earth. After all, that's what God told them to do. So they're doing something right. And secondly, the daughters were born to them. That surely the daughters were both of both lines, of the good and the bad, you might say. And it goes on to make no distinction between those two lines. It's just simply saying that mankind as a whole is now reproducing and doing these things. So we're looking at the whole of mankind. Perhaps the reason why the singular Adam is used in verse 1, when Adam began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, but it's with the definite article, when the humanity began to reproduce, it's talking about the whole mass of all of chapter 4 line and all the chapter 5 line. It's mankind in general that's in view. There is a third interpretation, and that is that the sons of God are the leaders of the society and of civilization, which is pretty well attested to by later archaeological finds, that the king, the leader of the people, was generally reckoned to be a son of their particular god. And often we've got an actual bit of masonry, which is a statue, and underneath it's written image and likeness. The image and likeness is the king, is the image and likeness of God Ra or God Astra or something or other. And that's the way that they were expressing the concept of being made in the likeness of God. They were the sons of their deity. And it's what, therefore it's very significant that in Israel and in the scriptures, the sons of God are seen as those who are everybody who's been produced, have been created. Adam was the son of God, but all of the descendants of Adam are sons of God. And that mankind is taking this concept, rather, God has taken this concept of the image and likeness and democratized it, thrown it out amongst all the people, so that we're all sons and daughters of God, whereas for the pagans, it's always their king and king only. And it carries on right the way through into the Romans, doesn't it? The Roman emperors regarded themselves as the sons of deities or gods themselves. So, trying to understand this very difficult passage, if we stick to the fact that these are spirit beings, they are referred to in the same way as they're interpreted in contemporary literature of the Jews at the time of Jesus. They're referred to as those who are the watchers, the spirit powers, the spirit beings, and are referred to in Jude and in 2 Peter. And in Jude and 2 Peter, and possibly 1 Peter 2, where it says, the spirits that were disobedient in the days of Noah, and they are kept in chains to the final judgment. So it seems that the simplest approach, and the traditional and the continuing and most satisfactory approach, is to see these sons of God as being spirit beings. But it raises the question, how do spirit beings see the daughters of men, that they were good, like Eve, same word, saw that the apple was good, good to eat, it was attractive, and took, and she took, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And those words are used for Eve. She made a choice. And it looks as though it's parallel to Eve that all this is going on again. But this time it's showing the male side of the picture. In Genesis 3, it's the female side. It's Eve who's leading the way in sin at the first place, or disobedience. Now it's mankind in general going through a similar kind of fall. Now, what does it mean they took wives from themselves for whoever they chose? It would be easy, and maybe there's a hint of this, to say that, well, it was a kind of irrespective arrogance. I'll have a wife whoever I like kind of idea. And if we had evidence that it was at this point that polygamy began, but it looks as if it's already begun anyway, or, and so there were lots of wives, or if there was a hint that the taking of them for wives was actually rape, and that they were being forced into sexual activity, it would be much easier to understand. I still think that the phrase "of whom they chose" does imply a certain hierarchy, which could be an arrogant one. But even having said that, it was the common factor in most societies, early societies, that the women were under the protection of the men, and they had to be traded off to whoever the father wanted to marry them off to. And who did he want to give a dowry to? He didn't want to give it to everybody, you know. And so there was a certain degree of restraint which would be necessary in most societies. So when it says whomsoever they chose, is it implying that it was a little bit of a grab rather than a negotiation, talking with the parents and so forth? Very hard to come to a conclusion. But we do think, obviously from what we're going to read, that there was something about it that was not godly. Let's put it that way. And it's paralleled, as I say, to the words that are used for Eve taking of the apple and seeing it was, the apple wasn't an apple, and saw that the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil was good for food. Then the Lord said, "My spirit," and it's another difficult verse, "my spirit shall not always strive with men." So it shows that whatever was going on, it was not pleasing God. "My spirit shall not always abide" is probably now the approved translation by most scholars. It's been debated for a couple of centuries. "My spirit shall not always remain with men, abide with men." That breath that I've already spoken, that God breathed the breath of life, and it opened up mankind, I'm suggesting, to the supernatural and to the spirit world, that God's saying, "I'm not always going to keep hanging around like this." In fact, he said, "I'm going to give you 120 years and then the flood comes." Because obviously he's just been frustrated, misused, rejected, and what's the point of abiding, of hanging around? And that phrase shows that whatever was happening in verse 2 was a bad thing rather than a good thing. The sons of God then, how did they actually go in and copulate with the daughters of men? First, I don't think it's insuperable to say well, they're spirits, how on earth can they have anything to do with fleshly activity? Because it was recognized and still is in lots of societies, and in paganism in particular, and fertility cults, that there is a supernatural element in the sexual activity. That the sexual drive, if it is not living in the breath of God, is living in the drive which is of the enemy and produces all sorts of perversions. Now, I know I'm reading an awful lot in at that point, but it is very likely, because God does disapprove of this, that the sons of God entered into human bodies, and these men chose or grabbed or took whatever they wanted to in the sexual realm. Though it does call them wives, but that may be just a euphemism to say that they were in a sexual relationship. Well, that could be the way that we're meant to understand it, and I think it's consistent, just if you carefully go through all the words that are used, but it would never mean that you could be definitive totally. There have been similar infusions of satanic power at various times in the history of the universe. It could be that there was agreement between fathers and men in the misuse of women, in temple prostitutes, in the offerings that were made to deities. And certainly it was recognized that you could have intercourse with a spirit power. It's a kind of a fleshly expression that you can have intercourse with God. You can know God, and you can give yourself to Him, and He can come and dwell in us. So there is that kind of parallelism that belongs, you know, to a perfectly healthy kind of religious state, and it is not in itself a perfectly healthy one. It is a perversion of the meaning of what it means to be inhabited by the presence of God. That's why the Spirit of God, the breath of God, is then referred to as, I'm not going to hang around all this long for you to go on living in spirit power, which is hellish, whereas I'm offering you my presence in order to dwell in you, so you live correctly. And that's what lies behind, I think, the perversion of that, of a lot of the fertility cult, that it's to do with a kind of a fleshly reproduction or reaction or interaction, I should say, of what God intended in a love relationship with Him. Make sense? It is, of course, you do have to put a lot into it to get the full picture, but I think it is consistent with the words that are used here. Then he goes on to say, nevertheless, because he is also flesh, nevertheless his days will be 120 years. Well, up until now, the days of people have been extremely long. Now it looks as though the age span is being reduced. Many people have taken the view that 120 years is that God is giving 120 years before the flood comes. Doesn't exactly say that, and of course there have been babies born the day before, so they wouldn't have had 120 years. So it didn't quite fit, although it could just about be the case. And when we move over after the flood, we'll find that I think only one person lives 123 years, something like that. It is, everybody is broken down, is smaller. Joseph 110, and so on. Abraham is 140, but Jacob and Isaac are around about 120, those ages. So there is obviously a reduction in ages, which could be therefore prophesied here, that this was God's intent. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, and later as well. That seems to be suggesting that the Nephilim, which were on the earth, whoever they are, we'll think about those in a minute, are all going to be washed up when the flood comes, but and afterwards, that there's either been a similar infusion of satanic or demonic activity and power, and Nephilim reappear, because they're very clearly related to what we've just been reading. about the sons of God going into the daughters of men, and instead of just simply and straightforwardly filling up the earth and multiplying, we're getting all this other activity taking place which God disapproves of. So there must be something of negativism about it. Yet when it's now taken up with the Nephilim coming into the picture, they appear to be the product. They are the ones that are brought forth from these kinds of unions. And the fact that they are there again after the flood, depending on how extensive the flood was, another question mark, which we're going to deal with this morning in the amount of time we've got. But how extensive was the flood? If everybody was actually washed out during the flood except Noah and Ham and Shem and Japheth, then how did these guys get into operation again? Well, there must have been another effusion. And maybe at different times in the history of mankind, there has been satanic activity that has got hold of human beings. And you certainly can, you could read that into Revelation, where it says the pit was open and the demonic comes out. It's as straightforward as that. Perhaps there are times when God allows the pit to be opened and Satanism gets into people's hearts and lives, and there is a perverting and a destroying of human beings. So this could be the case, and we certainly are aware, or maybe we should be more aware today, that in the days of Jesus there suddenly is a whole infusion because there are demons all over the place. Whereas unclean spirits only once in the Old Testament. But when Jesus appears, they pop up everywhere. So maybe there is something to be understood in this. But it is reading into the text to say there was another kind of infusion of satanic sons of God like that we've got here. Not unlikely. Now the reason why these seem to be the product of what's been going on, the Nephilim on the earth in those days and also afterwards, what days? When the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bore them children to them. So the Nephilim, whoever and whatever they are the product of this somewhat perverted kind of sexual activity that I'm suggesting, which instead of having the breath of God behind it, it's got the breath of demons. This is the product, which is what? The Nephilim. Because the word is made up from the word to fall. The fallen ones were on the earth in those days and also afterwards, even when even the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and they bore children to them. They were, these Nephilim, these fallen ones, the mighty men who were of old, men of a renown, men of name. Well, it seems to me that, first of all, there are lots of hints like this in the scriptures which reflect traditions. And there was the tradition of the heroes and the mighty men, not just the Goliaths that come a bit later, but the Hercules, the story of the Odyssey and so on. These heroes were half God, half man in the legends of the classics and of other finds that we've made. There was always a place in nearly all histories of some kind of copulating men and gods. Because that's what Hercules was. He was the product of Zeus and some beautiful woman. And but where do these stories come from? How do they get into the human psyche? And here's perhaps a reflection of those things again, that something did take place of men of great strength that came forth from this kind of activity. And we see that they pop up again, the Nephilim, when we move into the later on in the Old Testament, as I say, not necessarily direct descendants from what's happening here, but in Numbers chapter 13, verse 33, as they went into the promised land, they said there were Nephilim in the land, and so they wouldn't go in. So these monstrous big guys are the ones who are again the product of some sort of this, and rather than being necessarily direct descendants of the Nephilim, they are just other Nephilim that have come into being, fallen ones. So this very, very quick, and it goes with just a couple of more verses, verse 5 and 6. This is the prelude as to why God had to wash out the whole of society, as far as the intention of these verses are meant to communicate to us, that God was not pleased with what's there. And then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was very great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts or the imaginations of his heart, and the word for heart is, as you must know, is not just the feelings, the thoughts of the heart. Phleb is the Hebrew word. It's where everything goes on inside, and is the driving power, the pump of the body, was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry he'd made man. He repented, literally. It's the word to repent. He was sorry he'd made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. It hurt him. It grieved him in his heart. So the heart of man is, it seems, irretrievably evil. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Pretty comprehensive. Whereas God's heart was that he was hurt, which is an evidence that he was a great lover. So there's man destroying himself and God being pained by it. And he was sorry. He wished he never made man. Now they talk about anthropomorphic terms, but surely God would have foreseen this if foreknowledge was the way that people talk about. And so why was he so surprised? Well, you could say, well, he was not surprised. He knew it was coming, but it still hurt him. But I don't know. It doesn't. You're not dealing then with a real person. I don't think God's foreknowledge is so comprehensive as some people make out. And he was pained that this is the result of man. He was pained over the first sin when it could have been otherwise. He was pained over this development of mankind getting worse and worse and worse, it seems. It's interesting that the words we got here for repent and made man and grieved are similar words which you got in chapter 5, verse 29. He gave us rest or comforted us from our work and the toil. The work of man, he made man, and the toil of our hands. I've got the exact lineups of the words, but the three words, repent, made, and grieved, are parallel by giving rest or giving comfort, work and labor or toil, work. And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I've created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and birds, because they're all under his jurisdiction. He is the Lord of the whole of the animal world. I'm sorry that I have made them. And so there is God's pain again. He's sorry. He's grieved. And the way that he's going to do it is, is the flood. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. It's rather fascinating that the word Noah is made up of two Hebrew letters. But it's the N and H, we would say, in English terminology. In English terminology, and if you turn them round, which of course you would do, if you looked into the eyes of someone, found favor in the eyes of the Lord, if you look into somebody's eyes, everything's the wrong way around. The rights become the left, and the left become the right. So if you turn around the word Noah, you get grace. Found grace, found favor. Noah found grace. Which is H and N. Hen. That's what we call Henry, isn't it? Hen. It's grace. It's grace. It's not Noah, it's grace. But if you turn Henry around, you get Noah. Well, there you are. So Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So let's keep looking into the eyes of God, otherwise, you know, lifting up our countenance, what Cain didn't do, looking into his eyes, finding grace. These are the records of the generation of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. It's a lovely description. Noah walked with God, like Enoch walked with God, verse 22 of chapter 5. Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch, verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So he walked with him such a long way, God said, well, it's a bit late to go home, and took him in, and he wasn't anymore on the earth. So Noah became the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth. The earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. Well, we're not going to get an awful lot of Noah in at this stage, are we? But he is going to come up pretty soon, so I suppose I'd better do something. Verse 13. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me." Noah doesn't say anything until you get to chapter 9. In fact, chapter 9, verse 25, when it says, "So he said, 'Cursed be Canaan, the sons of the of servants.'" So it shows what an awful condition everybody's in, including even Noah when it comes to that. But we'll come to that later. Noah is just obedient. Everything recorded is just silently. Well, he probably spoke, but we don't get any record of him speaking to God. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come. The earth is filled with violence because of them, and I'm about to destroy them from the earth, with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood, and you shall make the ark with nests, rooms, and you shall cover it." This gopher wood is not mentioned elsewhere than for the story of the ark. "Cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it: the length of the ark, 300 cubits, and so on and so forth. And you shall make a window for the ark, and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. And you shall make it with a lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which there is the breath of life. From under heaven, everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, and you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. The birds of their kind and the animals after their kind, every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind shall come and keep them alive. No need to bother about the fish, they look after themselves. As for you, take to yourself some of all the food which is edible and gather it to yourself." That's clean food. "And it shall be for food for you and for them." Thus Noah did according to all that God has commanded him. So he did. Now it is true that people have reconstructed the ark and taken on board its size, probably computerized it by now. Press a button, see how many animals you could get in it. And it seems a very large salvaging boat that we've got here. It's hardly a boat because we don't even know whether it had a sort of spearhead at the front or not. It was a bit of an oblong affair rather than anything else. And the way in which it's made is significant because I believe it is pointing the way to the future as to what is going to happen through Jesus salvaging mankind. If you look in, for instance, well, in the Gospels, don't look there for a minute, in the Gospels Jesus mentions, "As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man." So he's pointing out this great catastrophe, which we're going to talk about in a minute, which overtook the earth, is going to be as equally threatening in the coming again of Jesus. There is something to take note of there. But the other passage is in Peter, 1 Peter, when Noah is referred to again in chapter 3 of 1 Peter. Verse 17, it's better if God should will it so that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, in order that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which he also went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison, who were once disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. So it's almost certainly, therefore, a reference to what we've read about these Nephilim and the spirits, the sons of God. Now they're being restrained and kept for the day of judgment. When the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah, during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through the water. And corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of the dirt of the flesh, but an appeal to God from a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into the heavens after angels and authorities and powers have been subjected to him. So there's a little micro cameo there of the way of salvation, all in the terms of baptism, but making it very clear it's not just literal water on literal dirt on literal flesh. It is an answer of a good conscience, a cleaned up conscience before God. But the identification of the salvation that was wrought by Noah gives us a legitimate reason for going back to the story of Noah and asking, is there anything there we can see about the salvation of Christ? Well, of course, one, the ark is not the picture of Christ as many people have taken it. Well, not strictly the Jesus Christ. The head is Noah, who has a family, and the family is in the ark. The ark is the means whereby the family of Noah is saved. The work of Christ, which is equally in wood on the cross, as Noah built an ark out of wood, his work is that which saves us, and he is the head of the family which is saved. To be a part of the family of Christ is the basic fundamental understanding of what it means to be saved. And the work of the ark was not only carving up a ship so that we've got a ship there to get into, but it has nests or rooms within it, because in the work of God are many abiding places, resting places. That's what a nest is, isn't it? It's a resting place. And we rest in Christ. Because it isn't just in the future, as many people take those verses in John to mean, that we will abide in Christ. We abide in Christ now. Those abiding places, as they're called, those nesting places are already there. I go to prepare. I go to work for you to prepare a resting place, so you can come and rest in it. And I will come again to you. And that coming again is in the resurrection, and by the gift of the Spirit, we will come and abide with you and dwell with you. It makes it very clear as you read on in John 14 to 15, that's where we rest in him. So we rest in the ark, and that of course is a place of faith. We don't get panicked when the rain comes and leap over the side and get drowned. We're going to rest in him in peace of heart and mind, and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. And the word for pitch is the word which is translated atonement sometimes. It's the word to cover. Atonement is the covering. And the covering that makes this boat float and not sink when the water starts to come is that it's pitched, it's covered inside and outside. And the reason why we don't sink and get lost and drowned is that we are covered. Or at least we are in a ship that's covered with pitch, with atonement, inside and outside. So there is a very beautiful picture of the work of Christ through the cross and the covering that comes. And that he therefore, and there's a window for the ark, which is interesting, and it's in the top. So you don't look out and see all the wreckage going on in the drowning or so. You can only look one way, you can look up. It's in the roof, it's in the top. And the door, of course, is at the side to let them in, but that's shut. When the door is shut, then you're watertight and you begin to move up with the flood. So, and there are three ranks, there are three levels, just like in the temple, funny enough. In the temple, you know, there are little cubicles, three rows of them like that down the sides of the brick, well, not brickwork, it's stonework, you're not allowed to use brick. And in the so it's a kind of a mini temple here, with the Christ family being saved. So that gives a little bit of a basis so you can, that would take a morning, wouldn't it, to interpret and apply that to all the people. But it's worth noting again that the word flood in chapters 6 to 9 of the flood is only here and in Psalm 29 verse 10. Psalm 29 verse 10. If I remember my statistics right, which says, the Lord sat as king at the flood. Yes, the Lord sits as king forever. So this is an expression of his kingship, of his kingdom. And the word and the flood is something particularly unique. It is unique because it says, I'm bringing a flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh. In actual fact, as we move on, we find that the water didn't only come down from above like rain, it came up from beneath. And maybe when we start to discuss with people, was it a worldwide flood? Was it just a local flood where human beings lived? Or was it a flood where some human beings were and they got washed away? It's not simple to answer that, because obviously the way that the story is written, if you were actually in the ark and you looked out, wherever you would see, you just see water, not realizing that the earth was curved because we're spherical. You wouldn't see Mount Everest and all those places. And so how did you know that the water was covering the whole of the earth? Well, you might think that God told you that. Okay, that's quite permissible. But on the other hand, if there were these great uprisings, and we know there have been, like we've got this volcano, is a little bit of a reminder, in fact. There have been massive upsurges, even since the flood, where disturbance has taken place. The Black Sea is the product of a massive great cataclysm of water pouring in, because it was like a waterfall, because it was one lot of water was higher than the other. And then it leveled off. It was a massive amount of water broke in. And similarly, some of the you've got these silicates or silicons, whatever they are, that are supposed to be floating around. If they get heated up too much, become glass in the plane's engines, all that sort of stuff. Well, archaeologists have been aware that volcanic activity in Greenland, Iceland, these places. The evidence of it's been found in the Middle East Basin, in Egypt and around those places. In other words, you can have colossal eruptions of power, which is just a little healthy reminder, even it might take our lives away, that we aren't God really, after all, which is not such a bad thing. And although it may be a bit too late for some to go under in the time, but those sorts of things have happened, and maybe a tidal type wave swept around the earth. That could be a worldwide washing, if you like. On the other hand, it could have been, just as it's recorded by what we see, somebody who was watching it and looking at it, as far as he could see, the whole of mankind and the world he could see has been washed away. So there are variants in these matters. I think that it is not very good science and not necessarily good biblical exegesis that the seven-day creation boys have promoted when they put out the Genesis flood book, which was 30 or 40 years ago now, which was trying to maintain scientifically that there is evidence for flood. There are bits and pieces of fossils on tops of mountains and who knows what, but to say that all the fossils were laid down during the flood is a little extreme and not easily provable. So it's better not to get into kind of pop science and try and defend the Bible from it. I think that from the terminology that we've got, if we treat it as somebody who is looking at what he can see and describing it, we're getting all that is necessary. If you could say that if it weren't just a local flood, and even if it were a worldwide flood, if it were a local flood, what is the point of making an ark and getting all the animals in it? Yeah, that's one of the points against a local flood. Why didn't the animals just run up the mountains at the side sort of thing and let the flood take place locally and then come back in again? So that's a reason to say we haven't got the whole answer if we just say it was totally local. But it does raise the difficult questions of evidences of people living in the far reaches of the Americas, for instance, and places where they don't seem to have been touched, although the majority of cultures have got some sort of flood story involved in them. Of course, if it were wherever mankind was, then as men and women start moving out into all the earth, they carry the stories with them. So that doesn't necessarily preclude that possibility. I just saw raising the necessary things to bear in mind and not necessarily saying we've got all the answers. As theology is a symbol of what actually is taking place, it's as clear as a bell. God wants to destroy mankind. And he said, well, I'm not going to do it again a second time, even if man is as bad as ever he was. So at least there's the promise there would not be a total flood to remove the whole of the human race until Jesus comes again, and then the judgment of course will be universal. These are just things to bear in mind when you're interpreting. You may get thrown up from the floor. People have argued that it's the number of folk from the period of Noah are easily understood in the terms of reproduction from that time, because it gets very, very fast when you get as big as we are now. So the reproduction could be that it's all from just the family of Noah in about 3000 BC kind of idea. Population. So those are just things bear in mind when you're expounding, that you don't make unnecessary difficulties for people, but stick to the theology and impress over the theology of the matter, which isn't the way it's used. We do have to bear in mind too, and it's perfectly fair, you could go through the Bible and you'd find a lot of places where the hyperbole is a fundamental part of Hebrew language. And you say, you know, like I've often quoted, the world and his dog is outside the house, and you mean about three or four people with a making a noise, and it's the way they would talk and the way we can expect people to talk. And as it says that for instance, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified by faith. But we know that not everybody's justified by faith, but you don't make that sort of distinction. Or but his own received him not, but as many as received him. I thought you just said that his own received not. There's many who received him, he gave the right to be called children of God. You could say that and expect to be understood. And so there are those sorts of statements one has to bear in mind. The Assyrians got up in the morning and they were all dead men. That's literally what it says. And which obviously they wouldn't have got up in the morning. But it's the hyperbolic way of talking about the completeness and the totality of what's what they want to get over. So bearing that in mind, let's have a quick look at, I've gone for another 5 minutes, I think, verse 15. Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone have I seen righteous before me at this time. You should take with you every clean animal, there's sevens, male and female, the animals are not clean, two, male and female. Also the birds of the sky, sevens, male and female, keep the offspring alive in the face of the earth. And after 7 more days I will send rain on the earth. 40 days and 40 nights I'll blot out the face of the land, every living thing I've made. Noah did according to all the Lord had commanded him. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood came upon the earth. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark, and the water flood and the clean animals were with them, etc. Right the way through to verse 22. And all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit, the Neshima, or the Ruach of the Neshima, you notice, died. It does seem as though the Bible quite clearly is talking about animals having spirits, and as the spirit of an animal goes downwards and the spirit of a man goes upwards, who knows, says the writer of the Ecclesiastes. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals, creeping things, the birds of the sky were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah was left, together with those who were with him in the ark. The water prevailed on the ark 150 days. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts that were in the earth, and you get the story of it landing on Mount Ararat. It rested on the mount in verse 4, is literally Noah'd on the mount. It rested, it Noah'd. And the waters decreased steadily. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made and sent out a raven through here and there until the waters were dried up from the earth. Presumably living on carcasses and the things that had died, he sent out a dove, which is not a carnivore, to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. The dove found her resting place for the sole of her foot. She returned to him into the ark, for the water was on the surface of the earth. But he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark to himself. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove from the ark. The dove came to him in the evening, so it came back a second time. Behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water had abated from the earth. Then he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, and she didn't return to him again. And it came in the 601st year, presumably that's Noah's 601st year, so this has lasted a year, in possibly a Hebrew, biblical year, 360 days. In the 601st year, in the first month, the water was dried up from the earth. Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. In the second month, the 27th day of the month, the earth was drying, and God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark and take all these living creatures with you. They could have all hibernated, of course. That's a faculty that seems to exist in all creatures. Verse 20, Noah built an altar, took of the clean animals and every clean bird, and offered up burnt offering in the altar. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Well, the intent of man's heart was evil from the very beginning. It was the reason why he destroyed the earth. Now the same reason is given as to why, or virtually the same reason, why he's not going to destroy the earth. And I will never again destroy every living thing. And then the harvest festival words, the earth remains, seed time, harvest, cold and heat, summer, winter, day and night shall not cease. So that's been the encouragement to many people when being in disasters, physical disasters. Verse 9, chapter 9, just a few things quickly. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Same thing as it said to Adam. So it's as though we're starting all over again. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast. It didn't say the terror would be on them before, but it looks as though having dominion over the animals was going to be a thing by fear. And every bird of the sky and everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea and the land you're giving, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you, and I give it to you as I gave the green plant. So now some people have argued that only up until now men were vegetarian, but it doesn't exactly say that. It means that now they were given permission to eat meat, whereas before they no doubt, I think, ate it, whether they were given permission or not. There's no evidence it wasn't eaten before then. Only you shall not eat flesh for its with its life, that is its blood. And this is a bit of theology, of course. It's to teach them that all life comes from God. Therefore, if you're going to take life and eat a beefsteak or a lamb chop, just remind yourself every time that it's not you that gives life, it's God that gives life. And that surely I will require your life, blood. From every beast I will require it. And from every man's brother will I require it. So part of the conditions of mankind to develop the concept of the sanctity of life. You don't take life cheaply. If you take it, you've got to recognize who it belongs to. The word brother there, from every man's brother, is this the second time the word brother has been used. So just as it was used, am I my brother's keeper, now it's used again, loving your brother, loving mankind as a family, as it starts all over afresh. Then a little poem, whoever sheds man's blood, by a man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful, multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. So whoever sheds man's blood, a murderer, like Cain. By man his blood should be shed, that's the executioner. So man is a murderer, now man is an executioner. In the image of God he made man, and man is the executor of judgment because he is the image of God. And he is saying that if you take a man's life as a murderer, then you have got in some way or other to make recompense, because it's something that's been made in God's image. And that is the most fearful thing about it all. So it's not just a bit of tautology, it is an actual poem which is going deeper and deeper and giving for the first time authority to mankind to execute judgment against his fellow man, even though he is once again the second time called his brother. Now that's important, because this is where the idea of the powers that be are ordained of God comes from. Doesn't come from the fact that God raises up Hitlers and Stalins and whatever else. It's that the concept of authority has been given to mankind. And here it is given in order to try and restrain evil. First of all, the resistance to evil is given by hard work. The sweat of your brow, you will eat your bread. Whereas before, it was easy going in the garden, now it's hard work in the fields as a labourer. Secondly, there is the restraint now given of human government, that we are meant to in some way or other govern ourselves. It doesn't say whether it's a monarchy or whether it is an aristocracy or whether it is a democracy. It just says there is a right within mankind to govern mankind, control mankind, and that is another second restraint on sin. We'll find a third one before we get to the end of these passages which are dealing with, before we get to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. I have mentioned before that Adam and those descendants from him, I didn't say it today, they are clearly indicating what is called the Neolithic man, the new Stone Age man. So whatever hominids existed before the new Stone Age man, they are not seen as those who were developing crafts and business and so on. That all came in with the herding of cattle and with the agriculture, which of course is what Genesis chapter 2 says. There was no man to till the ground, is the reason why the mortar system was treated differently. So now we've got to the place where it's not just anarchy. God is giving, maybe people were eating meat before, now he gives permission for it. Maybe it looks as ancient societies had some sort of government. Now God is giving legitimacy to it. So it is a God-given gift to restrain evil. Just quickly look at this passage which has been so terribly used. The first thing that Noah says, I pointed out to you, was when he sort of wakes up from his being drunk with wine, verse 24. You know the story, I'm sure. He woke from his wine when he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Now, is that his youngest son or his youngest grandson? Because what the story goes, that having got drunk, he was uncovered himself inside his tent, verse 20, 21. Noah began farming, planted a vineyard, drank wine, became drunk, uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it on their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. In other words, treating their father with some degree of reverence. And their faces were turned away so they didn't see their father's nakedness. Right from the very beginning, Jews have found nakedness a great issue. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Now, is that a reference to Ham? How do we know he's the youngest son? Or was it a reference to his grandson? The same word used for son and grandson. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Because if it was Ham who told the brothers and said it in some kind of mockery, why curse the grandson? Bit unjust. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he'll be to his brothers." Now this is, I think, not teaching us something which is God ordained, that the Canaanites should be cursed and eventually all be destroyed, because and or that people have said Ham means dusty or dusky, and therefore he was a black man, and therefore "cursed be Canaan" means that black people should be subjugated by his brothers and they should be servant of servants. That appalling, disgusting interpretation, and you find it even in some textbooks. It's incredible. Well, for goodness sake, Canaan is not even black. He's an Indo-European or possibly Egyptian, but living in the land of Canaan. And they were not black people living there. So why pick out Canaan and make it look as though it's black people? Whatever colour, we don't even know what colour Ham, Shem and Japheth, any of them were. But he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." And that has been mangled into, "May God enlarge Japheth," in other words, Indo-European people, "let him dwell in the tents of Shem," that is the Semites, and the Semites, the Arabs, and the Jews, and all around the Middle East basin, "and let Canaan be his servant," meaning the black guys are going to be the servants. All you have to say is, well, when Japheth is, if you're going to, you know, take up this literal stuff and so on, when the Indo-Europeans go and live in the tents of the Arabs, in the tents of Shem, then maybe we'll listen to your silly interpretation, or your silly mangled reinterpretation. It's talking about the Canaanites. It's probably preparing the way for how they eventually get slaughtered. But let's remember this before we go any further or even try to justify the slaughter of the Canaanites. Noah is waking up from a drunken stupor and sees the condition he's in and doesn't really know anything that's been going on because he's been drunk. And it's irresponsibly opening his mouth. When he kept his mouth shut all the way through the story of the flood, things were going well. Now he sort of just pours out his... he lets his liver loose and spews it all out. And bad speech and bad talk becomes a cursing which has pursued the Canaanites until eventually the slaughter takes place, whatever. It isn't because God likes it this way. And it should be a warning to us about, one, strong drink, two, about getting drunk, and three, about irresponsible speech, which does far more damage than ever anybody can imagine. Because like dominoes falling down, it bounces on and bounces on and bounces, and it hits the next one, hits the next one. When we speak good things, that's blessings, good things, that is beautiful speaking, eulogia, blessing people with eulogia, beautiful words. We fill up a pool of blessing which people can live in and dwell in and enjoy. When we speak evil things about one another, we're cursing one another and filling up a whole pool, a cesspool of filth, which people then are forced to live in because of our speech. I think that is the lesson to learn from this story of Noah, rather than some foolish, mangled kind of interpretation which got nothing to do with objective fact. Can't see the black man anywhere at all in this whole picture, except that we just don't know the colours of Ham, Shem and Japheth. But it was used by people, especially in the southern states. It's still that term. There's a particular one volume Bible commentary which is still published. I've forgotten which one it was, which had this silly interpretation. Well, silly, it's wicked. So wicked, and it shows again how irresponsible talk can do damage into people's lives. Change history, sadly. Okay. Enough, no more. Not so sweet as 'twas before. To quote the bard.